Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing? I mean, nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to Dave the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Program, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grief process. You know, with roughly 100 million caregivers in the U.S. and Canada alone, that's about a third of the population. That means that everyone probably knows someone caring for a loved one. Join Dave and his guests now and every Wednesday at noon Pacific time as they discuss avoiding caregiver burnout and surviving grief. So find a comfortable place to relax, kick up your feet, and prepare to feel better and to receive practical tips and tools that you can start using immediately to get you through today and every day so you can survive your tomorrows. But not just survive, but to live life fully and abundantly. Yes, you heard me right. That is a possible goal to achieve. And now, here's your host, Dave Nassani. From Los Angeles, the Big LA, welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I'm Dave, the caregiver's caregiver. We are on the Worldwide Blog Talk Radio Network, as well as seven other audio and video platforms, including YouTube and iTunes and Stitcher and, gosh, I don't even know. There's a whole ton of them. Our goal here is to do our very best to help you avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout. And we have an exciting show planned for you today with my lovely co-host, Linda Bice. Say hello, Linda.
Hi, everyone.
Today we'll be interviewing a very interesting guest, attorney Nancy Cavey. And you will not want to miss this show. She's going to talk all about Social Security disability benefits, and even what if your student loan is in trouble and it needs to be discharged and you're disabled. Good information for caregivers. So as I said, I'm your host, Dave Nassani, and this show is to caregivers of every single kind. The one thing we know about caregivers is that they are caring, selfless, sacrificial souls, but they have this tiny little problem. They're very prone to burnout because they tend to put everyone else's needs above their own. Now, we can learn a lesson from the airlines who tell us that in the event of an emergency to put your own oxygen mask on first. What an amazing metaphor for all of life. Take care of you first, not out of selfishness, but out of survival. You know, selfishness is not a dirty word in caregiver circles. I know it is, but it shouldn't be. Now, we also talk about grief and loss and the devastating effects it can have on us. It sometimes throws us into this thing called the grief process. Now, it could take days or weeks or months or years to get through it. Everyone is different. Nobody likes to rush someone's grief. But come on, if you've been grieving for a loss for 5, 6, 7, 10 years, it's time to move on. And if you kind of feel like you're stuck and you want to move on, we can help you through that. So I do want to take this time now to thank my last week's guest, Peter Rosenberger, on holiday tips to relieve stress. We know there are lots of stressful moments in a holiday. And I just want to remind you that interview and all our interviews, including this one we're doing right now, is on our website, caregiverscaregiver.com, as well as all those other platforms that I mentioned before. And we're so excited that my new book, It's My Life Too, Reclaim Your Caregiver Sanity by Learning When to Say Yes and When to Say No, is a bestseller on Amazon in three different categories. And we're still on my national book and media tour. It's kind of tiring, but we're trudging along. And my goal is appearing on all the national shows like Dr. Oz and Good Morning America, hoping to make that coveted New York Times best-selling list. So far, I've appeared on 16 morning shows all across the country since October 6th, and I'm booked on 8 more, including an internationally syndicated morning show, I'm told, The Flash. So now that makes me an international caregiving awareness advocate, and I am humbled by all of that. So we just want to let everyone know that caregivers are dying. You know, 30% of them die before the ones they're caring for. And the ones that don't die, well, they just get sicker than the ones they're caring for, often needing a caregiver themselves. And that's just unacceptable, in my opinion. And the world needs to know it, and the government needs to know it, and the politicians need to know it. And I guess I'm the one to tell them. Well, enough of that. Hey, a big welcome to my guest, Nancy Cavey. Welcome to the show, Nancy. So excited to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Good. And we can hear you and everything. Why don't you take a minute or two? I like to do this with the guests and just introduce yourself. Just who is Nancy Cavey and why were you put on this earth?
Dave, my father, who was a World War II Navy Air Corps pilot, became disabled when I was a teenager. He was diagnosed with leukemia and he had to make that difficult decision to stop working and apply for benefits. And it was a tough one. I watched him struggle to make that decision. When he made that decision, he applied for both Social Security disability benefits and long-term disability benefits. And I watched my mom and dad go through that process, every month getting forms filled out for the long-term disability case, hoping that the doctors would fill out the forms and hoping that he'd continue to get his Social Security disability benefits and his long-term disability benefits. So that experience, living with in the home of a disabled worker, has been just crucial to who I am and what I do. Unfortunately, I was not able to have him see me graduate from college. I went to college in 3 years, hoping he'd see me graduate. But he died just weeks before I became disabled, knowing that I was going to go to law school to represent folks just like him. And you can hear that passion in my voice. And I bring that passion to my disability law practice. So, Dave, that's who I am and why I do what I do. I owe it all to my dad.
So how long have you been a lawyer now?
37 years.
Wow, 37 years. I've owned my gas station for 37 years, so I know that's a long time to be doing something. So do you ever feel like you want to change or you ever get burned out with being an attorney? Or
No,
are you just
actually,
so passionate about it that you love it?
I love it. I wake up every day thinking how I can help folks get the disability benefits they deserve and sort of be a guide and a shepherd to them during the disability claims process, because I know how difficult it is. And I certainly appreciate how difficult it is, not only for the person who is disabled and needs a caregiver, but how it can impact the caregiver. I saw the difficulties my mom went through dealing with my father's illness. And I'm so fortunate that you and your co-host have this show that help caregivers who really need your guidance and direction and somebody who's been there who can lead the path for them.
Well, Linda and I have certainly been there. So, Linda, have you had any personal experience with disability or anything like that?
Well, it took us 7 months to get disability for my husband, which seemed like an eternity for us, but when I hear others talk, that was like really quick. It takes years for some people. So, but 7 months it took us, and it was 7 months of filling out every kind of form you can think of. And I see, I didn't think about having an attorney. I just did it all myself. So it was trial and error, and step by step learning as I went. And it was a learning process, a very aggravating learning process.
So Nancy, is 7 months a long time to apply and receive?
That's very short. In fact, the national
That's
average is about
sad.
24 to 36 months,
Oh
depending
my
on where you
gosh.
live.
Because
Yes.
it's the government, right?
It's the government. And Dave, most people don't understand what they have to do to prove a Social Security disability case. So if you don't mind, let me explain the five questions that the Social Security Administration asks in looking at a disability claim. I think if you understand these questions, then your audience will have a better understanding of what needs to be proved. So the
Is it an
first question is,
application process or is it like you're suing them for it? I mean,
oh,
how does it
no. Well,
feel?
it's a the first stage is an application, and it's a pain in the rear end. You have to give them information about your work history, your medical history. You have to fill out forms about your activities of living and problems that you have. The Social Security Administration goes and gets your medical records, but I found that it's much more helpful if you actually submit your medical records as part of your application. But there's a secret that Social Security never tells you about, and that is there are forms called residual functional capacity forms. Well, what are those? They're forms that are designed to get from the doctor information about the diagnosis, the objective basis of the diagnosis, but more important, about a person's functional, cognitive, or psychiatric restrictions. Because the question, Dave, ultimately is, can the applicant go, do they meet a listing, a medical listing, which is difficult to do. But more often than not, Dave, it's can the applicant go back to their past work they did in the 15 years before they became disabled? And if not, is there any other work in the national economy that this person can do in view of their age, their education, their skills, and their restrictions? So it's all about medical proof and getting your doctor to cooperate, filling out forms. And that's a big secret that the Social Security Administration never tells a Social Security disability applicant and makes it difficult for them to get the benefits.
Do you mean that they can retrain you in a different vocation if necessary?
No, retraining is not really a big issue, though, depending on your age. If you're a younger individual, 20s, 30s, 40s, there's a presumption that you can be retrained. And you've got to beat that presumption by having your doctor indicate what you can't do. If you get a letter from the doctor that says you can't work, that's not good enough. You might as well throw that in the garbage can.
Really?
The Social Security Administration wants to know how long you can sit. How far can you walk? Do you need to change position? How much can you lift? Can you bend? Can you stoop? All these sort of functional issues to determine, hey, can this person go back to the lightest job they did in the 15 years before they became disabled? Or work in this mythical national economy?
Do they accept your doctor's records or do they want you to go see their doctors? Because I remember my mother-in-law hurt her back on the job bowling, and so she was on disability. And when Reagan came on board, she blamed him for, he was trying to get rid of all the corruption. But she's one of the ones that fell through the cracks because she went to some quack doctor, she says, who says, touch your toes. She touched her toes and said, okay, you're good. And, she's got like five doctors saying that she's disabled, she can't work, but some quack said, you're good, and they took her off a disability. I mean, how does that work?
Well, your mother-in-law is absolutely right. Ronald Reagan made a concerted effort to remove people from the Social Security disability rolls, and her experience was exactly what happened then. Now it's a bit different. If the initial application and request for reconsideration is evaluated by a state agency called Disability Determination Services, I call them dumb, dumber, and stupid. And the reason I call it BDS dumb, dumber, and stupid is that if you don't give the Social Security Administration the medical records and the residual functional capacity form, they've got to think. And if they
No,
have to
we don't
think,
want him to
Dave,
think,
they're going
no.
to find out. So if your records don't tell the story about what you can and cannot do, the Social Security Administration will schedule a consultative medical examination
With their own
who
doctor,
will, yeah, who's hired
AKA the
to.
quack.
Well, I use a different phrase. It's liar for hire. The
Oh,
liar for hire's job is to tell the Social Security Administration that you can work at least in a lighter or sedentary capacity. So the best way, the easiest way to win your claim from the very beginning is to have your medical records, to have a residual functional capacity form, and quite frankly, to be represented by an experienced Social Security disability attorney who knows how to help you tell your story, because otherwise it's really a matter of luck as to whether or not you get those benefits.
now, I know you're an attorney and I'm asking you a leading question, but is it necessary to have an attorney represent you in this, or is it like Linda, easy enough for an intelligent person to kind of muddle through it? Because apparently she got it done in 7 months. I don't know.
Well, quite frankly, I think she was lucky, and I don't
Or
know the
blessed.
severity of, or blessed. Either way, the answer is it's very tough to get Social Security disability benefits these days. If two-thirds of initial applications are denied, if they're
Really?
denied, you have to file a request for reconsideration, and two-thirds of those applications are denied. The
Really?
statistics do show that the chances of getting benefits are improved by having an experienced Social Security disability attorney. So,
As with anything, yeah.
you owe
What
it to
I
yourself
did,
and your family to get those benefits.
what I
what were you
did
saying?
was took the file that they gave me at the hospital to the Social Security office and let her copy all that. And then several months later, that was in, this happened on Christmas morning, 2006. Well, in January, I'm at the Social Security's office, filing and all this. Well, We had brought him home. He was in the hospital for a month. Brought him home, and I had put him in the shower. So this was all new to me. I didn't know about how he would pass out, you know, frequently. So I put him in the shower, and all of a sudden he passes out. He falls and hits his head on the faucet, busts his head open. We're calling 911. You know, we're at the hospital. And see, they had already set up a thing for us to take him to their doctor, right? Well, he spent 2 days in the hospital with his head, you know, where they stitched him up to make sure he didn't have a concussion, excuse me. And during that time, the doctor that was taking care of him, she knew all, you know, what we were going through and how much brain damage he has, okay? When I brought him home, we opened the door and the phone was ringing. It was the Social Security office. And I was telling her that we were just coming in from the hospital, and she asked what was wrong, and I told her, and she said, "Can I contact the doctor that took care of him?" And I said, "Sure." And I gave her all the information. Well, the next day I got a call back from the girl. She said that they had canceled the appointment with their doctor and that they were going to go ahead and approve his Social Security. But it still took, you know, until July before we got his first check.
So what happened there, Nancy? What do you understand why it happened and what?
Yeah, absolutely. The severity of her husband's condition is key. He had a brain injury. Then the Social Security Administration is more likely to award benefits in the case of a severe medical condition such as a brain injury. The second thing that happened is Linda was fortunate to have a doctor who was willing to cooperate and communicate with the Social Security Administration about the severity of her husband's condition. And so those two things were really key in the early award of those Social Security disability benefits.
Well, why wouldn't a doctor cooperate? I mean, you're giving him all this money. You would think that at least in appreciation he would cooperate. What's going on in their minds?
Doctors will tell you they didn't go to medical school to learn how to fill out forms. They want to practice medicine, not fill out forms. And so there are many times I have to tell my clients that your doctor may be a great physician, but if they aren't going to fill out forms, then we need to find a doctor who is willing to fill out those forms to help you get the disability benefits. Because what's also important, Dave, is once you get Social Security disability, after you've been on benefits for basically 29 months, you're eligible for Medicare. And so in addition to getting your money benefits, ultimately you get medical benefits. And so if your doctor isn't going to cooperate, then you need to find somebody who is willing to help you get those benefits because they're valuable lifelong benefits.
So when we're interviewing for doctors, let's say, you know, we already have a doctor or we're going to get a doctor, what are some questions we need to ask to find a good doctor? And we're planning on filing for disability so that we are sure that this doctor is going to be a team member and not just a lazy bum.
Well, the first question is, will you support my claim for Social Security disability? Many times people are stunned to read their medical records and find out that their doctor doesn't believe that they're disabled. The second thing you have to ask them is, are you willing to fill out forms for my Social Security case? And if they say, "No, I don't support your claim," or "No, I won't fill out the forms," then you need to find a new doctor.
So obviously, you believe in second and third opinions if necessary.
Absolutely.
Have you ever gotten a second or third opinion, Linda?
You know what? We have been so blessed with the doctors. And the doctor we have now is just, I mean, he will do anything for our family. And it's, So, yeah, we've been so blessed in all that. We've never had a doctor that didn't,
Linda
go above
herself,
and beyond.
Linda herself has had a challenge with a brain tumor, a brain cyst, which is, you know, not uncommon. Like I said, caregivers sometimes get sicker than the people they're caring for. So you had a good doctor. Was it the same doctor or a new doctor?
Well, I went for my yearly physical at my gynecologist, and he's the one that sent me to a neurologist. The neurologist sent me for a oh my goodness, my mind just went blank, for a scan. And that's when she found, at first they thought it was two tumors, and then they did another scan, and this time with contrast, and discovered that the one in the back of the brain is a cyst, and the one in the front of the brain is a tumor. But they are 100% sure that it's not cancerous. This all started in July. As a matter of fact, when our son was in Peru is when I was diagnosed. And so they're just going to keep watching it because it's, you know, it's risky to do surgery. He said it's risky to not do surgery, but it's more risky to do the surgery. So they're just going to keep an eye on it and just make sure it's not growing. But the cyst, they said it's not anything to worry
about.
So
do you work? What do you do for income?
Me?
Yeah.
We live on David's disability.
Okay, so you...
Yeah, we went from like, you know, like $100,000 a year down to like nothing for 7 months, and then to $16,000 a year. So, yeah.
So share with Nancy about your husband briefly, because she doesn't really know what's going on,
right.
Why he's getting disability or anything like that.
Yeah, when he was 49, on Christmas morning 2006, he went into cardiac arrest, and he was dead for 1 hour and 20 minutes before they hooked him up to life support. And he has severe brain damage. And then the year after that, our only son was paralyzed from the waist down due to a rare virus called acute transverse myelitis. And so that was been a rough 11 years.
Well, thank God for the disability.
You and your family are obviously very strong and blessed.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. God carries us through every single second of this.
Yes, her faith is very strong as well.
Well, you know, this brings up a point that I think every caregiver needs to know. Many caregivers will stop working. And when you work, you are contributing to the Social Security system. When you see that FICA withholding from your paycheck, that is going in part to the Social Security Disability Insurance Program. So Social Security isn't a welfare program, it's a disability program. But that insured status ends 5 years after you stop working. So if the caregiver stops working to care for their loved one and they become disabled, they've only got 5 years from the date they last stopped working to apply for Social Security disability benefits. If they wait to year six, they lose their Social Security disability insured status and may only be eligible for SSI, Social Security Supplemental Income, which is asset-based. So
what if Linda goes and gets a part-time job, maybe 1 or 2 days a week, 4 hours a day, something? Would that qualify her again to restart the clock?
No, unfortunately. You have to work 20 out of the last 40 quarters and earn at least $1,100 per month. So let's say Linda was working at the time her husband became disabled, and she stopped working, and then subsequently she developed the tumor that she has within that five-year period of time. She should be applying for her own Social Security disability benefits. But if she waits too long, she loses her insured status. So I see times where caregivers are not paying attention to their own needs, are forgetting that they should apply for Social Security disability benefits if they can't work. So I think that's something very important for caregivers to know, is that you can't ignore your own medical health. If you can't work anymore, you need to be applying for Social Security disability benefits.
Yeah, that's common with a lot of caregivers. How long has it been since you've worked, Linda?
Oh, my goodness.
Over 5 years, I assume.
Oh, yeah. I've been taking care of David for 11 years.
Wow.
And I had quit work when Trammell was two to stay home and raise him, and then I homeschooled him. So, oh, have mercy, that's 22. He's 24 years old. So that's 22 years. I did do some
promotion. So now you work just for no pay.
For right. I'm a volunteer.
You're a hard worker, yes. Well, listen, let's take a break. Hold that question, and we will be right back. Don't go away. Dave Nassani, the caregiver's caregiver, has just released his sixth book, entitled It's My Life Too. Reclaim your caregiver sanity by learning when to say yes and when to say no. It was specifically written for caregivers who know they should be putting their needs first, but just don't know how. Dave is the sole caregiver to his wife, Charlene, since 1996. He knows firsthand what caregivers are going through, because he is one. And he now speaks all across the country, offering caregivers his incredible caregiver support package. Even the airlines tell us that in the event of an emergency, put your oxygen mask on first before you help your child with their mask. They know that those who don't heed their advice often black out, thus becoming unable to help either themselves or their child. And caregivers are exactly the same way. It's My Life Too. Reclaim your caregiver sanity by learning when to say yes and when to say no. We'll help caregivers who are neglecting their sleep, diet, and social life, and learn to put their needs first. Pick up your copy today, or buy one for your special caregiver, on sale everywhere, and at caregiverscaregiver.com. And we're back with Linda Cavey and, no, Nancy Cavey and Lissy. I told you I do that. Nancy Cavey and Linda Bice. So, what was that question before we went to break that somebody was asking?
That was, you were talking about, okay, what if something happens to David, and then I turn 63 or 65, do I draw Social Security off of him, off of his name? How does that work?
The answer is ultimately yes, you can draw Social Security disability off of your husband's, but when he reaches a normal retirement age, his Social Security disability benefits will then become Social Security regular retirement benefits.
Will it remain the same or go down, or how does that?
It will remain the same, and in some instances can go up. What happens technically is when your husband became disabled, the rate at which his benefits were going to be paid got frozen at that point based on his earnings. It's a technical issue, but it can mean more money in your pocket.
Okay.
Well, that's good news. Yeah, my wife became disabled 21 years ago, and I don't remember how long the waiting period was, but I think within a year she had disability benefits from Social Security, because obviously she couldn't work anymore. And she's been getting ever since, with just meager increases, cost of living increases. It's roughly about $550 a month. But will she get that forever, and will it ever like increase more than a few pennies?
Unfortunately, the increase is based on the cost of living adjustment, is based on the CPI, Consumer Price Index, which has not gone up much. And so I get this question all the time, Dave, will my benefits go up? And the answer is no. The only way they'll go up is with COLAs, and the COLAs are so small that it doesn't really make a difference.
But they won't end. They'll basically go on until you die, right?
Correct.
Except in my mother-in-law's case.
Well, I won't talk about your mother-in-law's case. But you know, the thing that also, from my perspective, is really important is the medical benefits that are associated with the Social Security disability benefits. Because many people who are working and become disabled will lose their group insurance. And their only resource is to try to COBRA that insurance coverage if they can afford it, and then use community resources until they get their medical benefits, which is, unfortunately, in the case of Social Security disability, is 29 months of, you know, paying for your own medical care. If you have a catastrophic injury, by the way, you are probably immediately eligible for Medicaid in catastrophic cases, because the disability is obvious. But I'm sure that some of your listeners are caregivers to folks who have, for example, spinal injuries, who may have had multiple back surgeries like fusions. Those cases are tougher than a case of seizures, brain injury, those sorts of things, because the Social Security Administration really thinks that people who've had back injuries, even people who've had multiple back surgeries, can go back to work. So those cases are much tougher. There is a bit of, obviously, a bias built into the Social Security system, in my view, based on the nature of the person's medical condition.
Yeah. Maybe some of those people making decisions need some back surgery and see what it feels like to have back surgery.
Well, you know, the sad thing, Dave, is that the Social Security Administration has been without an acting commissioner for over 5 years.
Why is that?
Because we can't get a commissioner through the United States Congress. We can't get a nominee through the Congress. And what's
even Obama couldn't get one through the Congress?
No. And the other problem, of course, is that the Social Security Administration budget has been cut significantly to the point where while there may be more judges than they used to be, there's not as much support staff for decision writers. In Tampa, for example, they're 1,000 decisions behind in writing a decision after a person has had a hearing. This delay is really absolutely unacceptable, and I would challenge everyone who is in your audience to call their local congressman and really demand that a new commissioner be appointed and that money be allocated to allow the Social Security Administration to hear cases timely so that people can get their medical and money benefits that they so desperately need. As Linda pointed out, those Social Security benefits, you know, the max can be in a range of $2,200 to $2,400 per month. It's difficult to live on Social Security disability benefits. And if you have to go months before you see those benefits, you can be losing your house, you know, your family, go without medical treatment. So, you know, I think that your audience is a powerful coalition that can make a difference in helping those people get the Social Security benefits they deserve.
Yeah. How did you pay the bills, Linda, during those 7 months?
We were blessed that we had a good savings account. And but, you know, there was our house payment was $1,100 a month, and David's medication was $1,200 a month. And that was just two things right there. So, you know, I went through our retirement a year, you know.
$1,200 a month even after the insurance?
We didn't have. See, when this happened, his job was over. No insurance, no nothing.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Fun times. but you know,
at least
what?
They were giving you the cheap insurance price, right? Because a lot of people don't realize that if they don't have insurance, you know, I look at my insurance bill and says, okay, $7,000 discount from Blue Cross, $6,500. Yep. And I'm thinking, really?
They'll
give you that $6,500 discount if you don't have insurance. A lot of people don't know that.
Self-pay, yeah. And one thing was we never got a bill from the hospital. He was in there for a month, and we never got a bill because
you are blessed.
When the doctor ordered for him to be put on life support, it took the team 45 minutes to get down there to put him on life support. So, yeah, we could have sued. You know, when I look back, you know, one of the nurses, that's how I had all the files, because one of the nurses came to me and said, I want you to take this. You're going to need it. And I was oblivious. You know, I was like, okay. Yeah, I didn't know what she was trying to say. But then when I tried to get him into Charleston Medical Center, and one of the doctors, the neurologist, had his nurse, I sent all those forms, and he had his nurse call me back and say, tell me to not contact them again. And that if she contacted me, she would lose her job. And I was like, what? And that she said, have you actually sat down and read what's in this file? I said, no, I haven't really had time. And she said, you really need to. So that's when I read that part about the doctor being really upset because the team didn't get down there.
Well, many times it doesn't do any good to sue, because we had a situation where, you know, they waited too long to diagnose Charlene, and she was in the hospital like within an hour. There's a 3-hour window before you get brain injury when you have a blood clot. And we hired an attorney before the year was up, and they just, you know, you need the testimony of one neurologist against another neurologist, and they just don't do that, and they just don't cooperate. And it's just, he just says, they're not going to testify against each other. So even if you would have tried to sue, probably, am I right, Linda? I mean, yeah, Linda?
Nancy.
Well,
Nancy,
the names Linda and Nancy have always gotten mixed up in my head for years, and it obviously hasn't stopped. Nancy.
Yes, I mean, it's difficult to find doctors who are willing to testify against doctors. And each state has a different malpractice law, and it is different criteria in each state. So there are cases that are successful. There are cases that are never brought because you just don't have the medical support. I
Let's
think
talk about,
that
go ahead.
I was going to say, if I had been counseling Linda and her family, one of the first questions I would have been asking her is, do you have short and long-term disability insurance? Because many employers do offer that as a benefit. And if the person has those short and long-term disability benefits, you'd be wanting to apply for those benefits because, again, that's another source of income that can be utilized while people are also going through the Social Security disability claims process. And many times, people who have short and long-term disability benefits can be maintained on their employer's group insurance longer, which is obviously crucial because you desperately need that group insurance coverage. So many times, the group insurance benefits will continue if you get short and long-term disability benefits. So again, for those people who are faced with this very difficult situation, a laundry list of questions should be asked, and that is, do I have group insurance? How long will that group insurance last? Under what conditions? Do we have short-term disability? Do we have long-term disability? Should I be applying for Social Security disability benefits, and how soon? So those are some, basic questions from my perspective that people need to be considering, even in face of extreme emergencies and in dealing with a crisis situation, because they can be devastated quickly, so quickly, financially and medically, if they don't take advantage of the benefits they have.
Is long-term disability and long-term care the same?
No. You can actually purchase a long-term care disability policy, and sometimes you'll actually find that within a long-term disability insurance policy. Long-term care, Dave, really will pay for care if a person can't engage in five basic functions, such as bathing, feeding, taking care of themselves. If your loved one is transferred to a rehabilitation facility, many times one of the first questions they're going to ask you is, do you have a long-term care insurance policy? And if you do, that's great. It's not uncommon, unfortunately, for, again, the insurance carriers to deny these claims because they don't want to pay them. They're very expensive. And again, that requires definitely requires a lawyer and certainly requires the cooperation of the doctor. Many times I've found that the facilities want to help because obviously they want they want to be paid. That's in the laundry list of questions is, do you have a long-term disability policy? And within the policy, is there a long-term care benefit, or do you have a separate long-term care policy that would pay those benefits?
So if Linda had a long-term care policy, would they be paying her right now?
They would be paying, yes, they would be paying her to be providing care for her husband.
Man.
And how is that different from disability, though? They seem very similar.
Well, disability is covering basically a person's inability to work.
Work.
Long-term care is
Doesn't
your
matter if you're
inability,
working.
it's your ability to maintain your bodily functions. Can you feed yourself? Can you dress yourself? Can you bathe yourself? And if you can't, you need assistance. And so long-term care insurance is just that, long-term care.
Yeah, and it is still relatively cheap if you can get it, in your late 40s, early 50s. I know I got mine for like $100 a month, and it pays an amazing amount of money, $400,000 over whatever time period. And because who knows, my wife didn't have one. Would have been nice,
Yes,
but I don't want to be a
yes.
burden to my children.
Well, and I think it's wise that you do have that policy and that you maintain the policy. Many
And it
times
hasn't gone
with,
up in all these years, which is amazing.
well,
I think
one of
it.
the things that I see, Dave, is that when people become disabled and while the application is pending, they may stop paying the premium, and the carrier might scream that, oh, you stopped paying, we don't care if you're disabled or not. We're not going to pay you benefits because you haven't paid your premium. So that's something that people have to be careful with just
Or
because
get the
you become
rider
disabled.
that will make the payments if you become disabled.
Right, called a
They have
waiver
all sorts
premium.
of riders on there.
Yes.
So let's talk about the denial process because two-thirds of the time they're going to get denied, right?
Correct.
So what
So,
is the ABCs in going through an appeal process?
okay, depending on what state you live in, Dave, there are two appeal processes. Most states will have what's called a request for reconsideration. So you have to fill out this form that says, I want you to reconsider my application, and you're asked to send in any new medical information that has occurred from the time of your application to the time of your request for reconsideration. That's basically 60 to maybe 180 days.
Hello.
But what's interesting is that
Are
the
you calling
application
me?
goes back to dumb, dumber, and stupid. And DDS really denies
Oops.
two-thirds of
I'm
those
on the
cases. So
radio right now.
once
I'm doing a
again,
radio
the
show.
key is to have that blasted residual functional capacity form filled out, and or at this point, really, if you haven't hired a lawyer, you need to hire a lawyer. It goes back, as I said, to dumb, dumber, and stupid, and they haven't gotten any smarter.
Do
And
lawyers do it on contingency, by the way?
yes, in fact, that's how we get paid.
Okay. So you're
The
highly
way yeah,
motivated.
the lawyer
Highly motivated to win.
the lawyer's fee is 25% of a person's back retroactive check up to a maximum of $6,000. It's a one-time fee and it's decided by a Social Security. So if you don't win, you don't get a fee. So you're right, we're really motivated to help the person get their disability benefits. If that request for reconsideration gets denied, then it's a really long train ride before you get in front of an administrative law judge. And as I said, depending on where you live, it could be 24 to 36 months before you get in front of an administrative law judge.
That's the appeal to the appeal.
That's the appeal to a judge. And you'll wait 36 months and you'll have a 45-minute hearing. And if you don't have an attorney, you really have made a huge mistake because I appear in court every day. I know these judges. I know what they want to hear. I know how to present a case to them. The judge's job is not to be the lawyer for the Social Security disability applicant. The judge ultimately, at the last stage, that fifth step, is making the determination as to whether or not Social Security owes those benefits. And they have the ability to say no. And if you lose, then you get to go to the appeals council, which is another year. So, doing it right from the beginning really is crucial.
Well, listen, we're going to take another break, so don't go away. We will be right back. Anytime we suffer loss, we grieve. And a lot of people don't realize what even the grief process is. But it could be 5 to 7 steps ranging from denial. I don't believe this is happening. Anger. Oh my gosh, I'm so upset this is happening. To a form of bargaining, how can I get out of this? To depression, which is a very serious thing because that often leads to suicide. And then finally, after you realize you have no more control over your situation and you're totally okay with the new normal that it brings, that wonderful, wonderful place called acceptance.
Being a caregiver takes a special person with passion and compassion. But even you can become a little burned out from time to time. The Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Show was developed to help you overcome obstacles, adversity, and burnout, as well as just having a place to rest, relax, and recharge your batteries. We've all been there, and you're not alone. Now, you can take the Caregiver's Caregiver with you. Get the top 25 radio shows in convenient form that plugs right into your USB car stereo or computer. Learn the techniques, tips, and encouragement we all need to better handle the day-to-day challenges. For around $1 per show, just $29.77, get the credit card-sized USB card to have with you anytime you need a caregiver's pick-me-up. Just go to DaveTheCaregiver'sCaregiver.com and order yours today. Go to DaveTheCaregiver'sCaregiver.com now. Consider it an investment in you, and ultimately, an investment in them.
And we're back with Nancy Cavey and Linda Bice. Yeah, I got that right. Linda, you have any more disability questions before we move on to student
Not
loans?
Not that I can think of right now. I know when you're talking about Medicaid and Medicare, stuff like that, it took us 10 years to get Medicaid for my husband.
Oh, my gosh.
10
wow.
years. And finally,
so
we got
long.
It last. Every time I filled the forms out and everything, they would deny over these ridiculous reasons. One time it was over a camper that I had sold years before to pay taxes because I didn't have the money to pay, you know, taxes. And it was during all of this, but they wanted me to get the information from when I sold the camper. And so I tried to contact the people that bought the camper because I didn't have any forms. And if I did, I had no idea what I had done with them because you don't keep stuff like that, you know? And so anyway, by the time I did contact the guy who bought it, he had sold it to somebody else. So he had no information. So when I got back in touch with the Medicaid people, they were like, well, you don't have this information, so we're denying you. It had nothing to do with what we needed or what we asked for. I mean, you know, it was ridiculous, things like that.
And how do you put up with all that frustration in your life?
It's just, you know,
you're amazing.
I always hand it over to God, and, you know, and so this time, yeah, and I was ready to give up this time because it was like you fill out forms and then they send you another form about this other form that you've just filled out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just what I always say that they keep doing that and they want you to just give up. So I almost gave up so many times this last time. And a friend of mine said, don't give up. Just keep, you know, whatever you have to do, just deal with it. Bite your tongue and just keep, you know, filling out the forms and sending them back. And I'm so glad that I did. But the weird thing was, it was like me pulling teeth to get this. So I send this form in and I wait a few weeks. We don't hear anything back. So I contact them and they say, well, we haven't gotten it back from this other office. So I got smart. I started calling the other offices. And one time it was in a pile of paper on this lady's desk. I mean, seriously, she was like, well, we never received that. No, that was what happened with my son. But anyway, we haven't received that email. So she goes down through and she goes, oh, wait, look, we do have that email. So one lady I even made friends with them, but they knew me by first name. I called these people so much.
Yeah. Linda, but I see you shaking your head, so you must agree that the government is. So here's her books about student loans, right? A lot of caregivers have student loans, right? A lot of caregivers maybe in school, maybe had to drop out of school. What do you say to a caregiver who had to drop out of school because they're a caregiver and they have a student loan? Is there any hope for them?
There is some hope, but it is rather difficult. You can unfortunately have to file for bankruptcy and list your student loans on the schedules and ask for what's called an adversary hearing. You have to basically prove that you're providing care to someone whose medical condition isn't going to change, and that that you won't be able to work because you have to take care of them, and you won't be able to pay your own student loans. And those circumstances are going to exist through the life of the loan. It's a very difficult and it can be a costly process. But in those situations where there's true disability that's going to be lifelong and the caregiver can't work anymore, you know, that's something that the caregiver should consider. Mm. On the flip side, Dave, if the person who is disabled has federal student loans, their federal student loans can be discharged under a total and permanent discharge that's available for federal loans.
Wow.
And there is an application that does require a physician certification, and the certification looks a whole lot like the information that's on a Social Security application.
Mm-hmm.
But the discharge application asks your doctor to answer questions about the diagnosis, the severity of the condition, the treatment, the medication, how the disabling condition prevents the student loan borrower from engaging in work in any field of work, what they can do in terms of lifting, bending, stooping, and That application has to be submitted within 30 to 60 days of the physician completing the form. It's submitted online to the Department of Education. They have a special unit that reviews all of these, and if they agree that the a person is disabled, then potentially their student loan can be discharged. Now, if you have a Social Security disability award, or ultimately a finding of unemployability by the VA, that's considered prima facie evidence. I mean, cold, hard proof that the disability is going to be lasting long enough to be disabled. And if the discharge is, you can be monitored for a number of years, you have to fill out forms, but ultimately the loan can be discharged. Now, if you go back to work, that sort of changes the whole process. If you decide that you want to try to attend school and take out a student loan, that will change the whole process. But I just think it's amazing that you can get a federal student loans discharged with a simple application. makes all the difference in the world.
And you know, you hear a lot of things that the student loans are, so many of them are in default, more than 50%. I don't know if that's true or not. And the government's doing nothing about it. Is that
true? I
mean,
it's horrendous. let me give you an example of, unfortunately, what's happening. There was a program called the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program that's available for people who work for nonprofits, who mm-hmm. work for the state. Maybe they're a teacher. Maybe they're a firefighter. And if you work for 10 years and you're making your payments on time, the balance can be forgiven and forgiven without any tax consequences. It actually came online October 1st of 2017, but our current administration and our education secretary are trying to gut this public service loan forgiveness program. So firefighters, teachers, you know, people who provide valuable services to us who aren't making a lot of money are going to lose their rights to get their student loans discharged.
How hard is it to get?
Well, you got to work 10 years for a qualified employer and make payments on time. You don't have, so literally this program came in effect October 1st, 2017, and the Department of Education is saying, well, no, we're not going to be looking at these applications. We're not sure we're going to continue this program.
So am I hearing you right? If you are doing all the right things, if you're paying your payments on time, you actually get rewarded.
Yes. Well, yeah.
Those are
the
probably
idea.
The people who least need their loan discharged. When you
no,
it's the people who can make their payments probably need it discharged. No.
Well, Dave, I would say to you, look, you know, firefighters, teachers, they provide valuable services to us, and they don't make a whole heck of a lot of money. you know, they're getting by, and if you can, you know, you're providing this public service, and you should be rewarded for providing it, and one way to do that is to have the discharge. And quite frankly, the other problem is that there are servicing companies who take advantage of student loan borrowers, who don't tell them about income-based repayment plans and say, oh, no, continue to defer your loan while the interest builds. Mm. You know, the fox was watching the hen house, and our former Department of Education secretary recognized that and basically took the servicing contracts away from people like Navient. Our current administration is giving them all back to the people who have been basically mistreating and defrauding student loan borrowers. So unfortunately, the landscape has changed, and not necessarily, in my view, for the favor of people who have student loans.
Mm. Well, we've covered a lot of territory here. How would somebody want to get a hold of you if they want to buy these books that you have, or if they want to ask you some questions or anything like that, or if they want to hire you?
I have two websites they can go to. Any student loan issues, Dave, they can go to www.mystudentloanattorney.com. That's www.mystudentloanattorney.com. If you have any Social Security or long-term disability issues, you can go to www.kvlaw.com, or you can call us at 727-894-3188.
Are the student loan cases on contingency as well, or no?
No, they are not. Those are normally done by me on a flat fee basis, depending on what needs to be done. What I do is an analysis of everyone's student loans and really provide them with a roadmap on how to manage their student loans and put them in income-based repayment plans, deal with garnishment issues, deal with discharge applications. So it's sort of an a la carte menu.
So do you require payment up front, or do you take payments, or how does that work?
On the student loan issues, we do take payments.
Okay, great. And Linda, how does someone get a hold of you if they want to learn more about the Bice family?
We've got a website. It's www.bicefamily, that's B-Y-C-E, family.weebly.com.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for showing up and doing what you do. We appreciate it a lot, and we're going to help a lot of people today. So God bless you, and thanks for coming on, and we'll see everybody next Wednesday at noon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Show. Make sure you tune in every Wednesday at noon Pacific Time and anytime afterwards on podcast to catch more of Dave and his tips to caregivers on avoiding burnout and surviving the grief process right here on the Worldwide Block Talk Radio Network. Goodbye.